if you like, the three horsemen of the apocalypse that are threatening people in the world most is poverty, as we just talked about, climate change, which we're not talking about today, and nuclear war, or war in general.
I think we'll talk a little bit about climate change at the end.
We'll talk a little bit about climate change at the end. So we're covering three of the horsemen of apocalypse, if you like. What I'm talking about here is the nuclear disarmament treaty, the nuclear ban treaty, the nuclear weapons ban treaty, which was lobbied for by a group that originally came out of Australia. It's international now, but this is ICAN, International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons. And their executive director in Australia, Jem Rommel, was in Adelaide on Thursday, speaking at the University of South Australia in City West campus. And I went along and recorded the talk and the discussion, but we haven't got time for the full thing. So what we got is most of Jim Rommel's talk, where she's talking about the current circumstances, and a couple of questions I actually asked myself at the end and her responses to them, because I think they're of interest to us. So this is Jim Rommel talking at the University of South Australia.
Why a prohibition treaty? What is this? Why is this a significant thing to have? So we can take lessons from other kinds of weapons. Worldwide, we've made substantial progress in controlling other kinds of indiscriminate and inhumane weapons. There are treaties that ban biological and chemical weapons, landmines, and cluster munitions, and these have dramatically reduced the production and the stockpiling, the financing, the export, and the use of these weapons, and it's certainly made it harder and harder for countries to justify having or using such weapons. So this is a fairly proven path to codify the illegitimacy of a weapon that can only have indiscriminate, unacceptable consequences in an international treaty that then provides the same legal standard for all states. And then that provides the basis, this treaty, and the motivation for the weapons progressive elimination. So the path is essentially stigmatize, prohibit, eliminate. And the norms established by prohibition treaties, they grow stronger over time, affecting even states that haven't joined. So, for example, the United States, in the same breath that they trash the nuclear weapon prohibition treaty, they'll boast their virtual compliance with the landmine ban treaty, which they opposed and that they still haven't even signed. And the Australian government also is a proud signatory of that treaty. So while there already were treaties before last year around nuclear disarmament, the non-proliferation treaty that you've heard about has in Article 6 an obligation on all countries to pursue disarmament. But it doesn't go far enough. That treaty doesn't explicitly outlaw the weapon, it doesn't set timelines, and the nuclear weapon states have been able to just delay progress 5 years at a time and just interpret that treaty as essentially permitting them to indefinitely keep their weapons. There are also nuclear weapon-free zones in many parts of the world. Australia is actually a party to a nuclear weapon-free zone treaty, the Rarotonga Treaty, and we are currently the only country out of more than 100 countries in nuclear weapon-free zones. We're the only one that still claims to rely on nuclear weapons for our protection. So while the NPT has sort of allowed the nuclear weapon states to paint a picture of them doing something, they can talk a lot about non-proliferation, and you'll hear this in the news all the time. This language is very popular, and it gives a sense that nuclear armed states and their allies are really doing something, but they can do that at the same time as blatantly ignoring the disarmament part of it. And of course, we know that while ever some countries insist on having these weapons, then others will seek to get them. So a ban treaty is a really important piece of the puzzle. It's not a silver bullet solution. It doesn't solve everything overnight, but it's a really essential step to seek the elimination of a weapon. It creates a new standard, a benchmark, and it raises the bar. And that benchmark is the same for all countries. It's not like under the NPT where you have the nuclear weapon states and then everyone else. It also puts the countries with nuclear weapons more on the defensive. They're on the back foot, and they have to work harder to justify what they're doing and to look reasonable at the same time when there's a new international legal standard. So a ban treaty also works in political and social forums to delegitimise the role of this weapon in our world and in our defence policies. And it changes how we see these weapons and how we think about them. And the status of this weapon hopefully is eroded gradually over time. And one thing that we can all work on as well is to use such a treaty to disrupt the financial flows that support the production of these weapons. So it was a pretty incredible feat of international diplomacy and cooperation to get through the treaty negotiations. The mandate was for 4.5 weeks only, which is breakneck speed in UN terms. And they hammered out this treaty. All of the countries that attended, with civil society present in the room, speaking, distributing materials, reporting, even allowed into the closed sessions as long as we weren't reporting. So there was a really unprecedented level of civil society involvement in these negotiations. And last year, on the 7th of July, when they reached the last day of the negotiating mandate that had been put forward by the General Assembly, they finished the text and sent it all off to the capitals to be approved and to be translated into the UN languages. And then there was a vote, which originally we were really worried about because we thought, oh, the conference, maybe they'll just adopt it unanimously and that will be fantastic. But one of the nuclear allies was there at the conference, the Netherlands, and we heard the night before the last day that they were going to call for a vote. And we got really nervous. We didn't know how solid were all these countries that had been there negotiating it. What if the number didn't come out that well? What if it didn't even pass? We just weren't sure. So there was a whole lot of campaigning and phone calls and emails flying around, and then they called for the vote the next morning, and we saw the screen go up with all of the countries, and then there was one country said voted no, one country abstained, and then 122 countries said yes. So you can't argue with 122 countries. So a little bit about what this treaty does and what it means. It frames nuclear weapons as an affront to humanity and it acknowledges the humanitarian and environmental harm of use and testing. It also includes acknowledgement of the disproportionate impact of nuclear weapons on women and girls and also on Indigenous peoples. The core prohibitions in the treaty are to outlaw the development, testing, transfer, hosting, possession, use and threat of use of nuclear weapons, and also to prevent countries from assisting, inducing or encouraging other countries to engage in any of those prohibited acts. It's currently the only international treaty in existence that sets out a pathway that countries can take to eliminate their nuclear arsenals, and they can either destroy their nuclear arsenals and join the treaty, or join the treaty and then negotiate with the states' parties a time-bound, verifiable agreement to totally dismantle their stockpiles. So in addition to banning nuclear weapons, the treaty also obliges states that join it to address the environmental harm caused by nuclear weapons testing and also to take care of people who have been harmed by these testing programs. Since the treaty opened for signature on the 20th of September last year, it's been signed now by 69 countries and ratified by 19. So signing says you intend to ratify, and ratification means that you've got all of your books in order and you're in compliance with the treaty and you agree to be bound by it once it enters into force. So it takes longer to ratify. There's usually processes, domestic processes to go through. Some countries need to enact new legislation. But all of those 122 countries, they're all most of them are expecting to be signing and ratifying. So I think we'll reach the 50 ratifications that we need for it to enter into force. We should reach that fairly easily, and hopefully within the next year, so the treaty should be in force by 2020.
Wow.
And it's also actually setting a record pace for ratifications when compared with the other WMD treaties. Yeah. So this treaty will help nations disarm. Many people say that we're sort of dreaming and idealistic to expect change on this, but it's those same voices and the same kind of people who said that we could never get a prohibition treaty to actually happen, but we proved them wrong. And while the status quo, it does seem intractable, certainly, but circumstances change. This treaty is exciting because it gives anyone in any position, anywhere in the world, a powerful new tool to pursue and to advocate for nuclear disarmament. So for activists, NGOs, local councils, state governments, parliamentarians, political parties, diplomats, heads of state, and also all of you, of course. Anyone who is in a country that is hostile to the treaty, a few people can change in that government, and then if they need something to use that is the new international legal standard because they support nuclear disarmament, then this treaty provides that tool. And the pressure is building on the nuclear weapon states and those that support them, including Australia. With every signature, with every ratification, this norm is strengthened. So the world is going to have to move beyond the bomb, and we hope that this treaty will be one part of the puzzle to get there. That shows you the green ones are the states that voted to adopt the treaty in July last year. The black ones are the countries with nuclear weapons, and the red ones are countries that claim to rely on the nuclear weapons of others for their security. On the 6th of October last year, the Norwegian Nobel Committee announced its awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize for 2017 to ICAN for our work to draw attention to the catastrophic humanitarian impacts of nuclear weapons, and also for our work to help bring about the Prohibition Treaty. So this has been pretty amazing, and it's provided it's directed sorely needed attention to the danger posed by nuclear weapons. And it gives a huge amount of encouragement for all of the people and all the governments who are working on this and who are working for an end to nuclear weapons. It opens doors as well. So unions, politicians, organisations who otherwise wouldn't have met with us, there's such an extra sense of legitimacy with the Nobel Peace Prize, as you can imagine. And it being awarded this prize also speaks to the power of what people working together with a vision and a plan can achieve. And I really feel that it honours the 73 years of people working against nuclear weapons and all of the nuclear survivors from around the world who have survived nuclear tests, and of course for the Hibakusha as well. It's the first Nobel Peace Prize to be awarded to any Australian-founded organisation. So we want everyone to own this and to be proud of this as well. And that's Hiroshima survivor Setsuko Thurlow. She was one of the two people to speak alongside the ICAN's director in Geneva, Beatrice Finn, to accept the award. This was in December last year in Oslo. So the nuclear weapon states hate this treaty because it undermines their self-given right to hang on to nuclear weapons. And we know that many nations are under pressure, very real pressure, from the nuclear weapon states not to join this treaty, but quite a number have already stood up against that and have signed on. This treaty is the new international standard. Australia, for our part, we've signed the treaties that prohibit the other weapons of mass destruction, the Landmine Treaty, the Cluster Munitions Treaty, but we haven't signed the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty. Our government at the same time says that it supports a world without nuclear weapons, so if it really does, then it must join the ban treaty. There's no other reasonable position. So our country claims to be protected by the newest US nuclear umbrella. Our government has been hostile to the treaty and actually tried to undermine the development of it and then boycotted the negotiations. So this was the first time Australia boycotted nuclear disarmament negotiations ever. Currently, we are essentially, I think of it as we're an enabler for the US nuclear arsenal, because we're saying that we're okay for this country to hold nuclear weapons on our behalf, and we're okay for them to be used somewhere in the world at some point, and to potentially radioactively incinerate millions of people at that time. Because that's what the threat is. That's what nuclear deterrent is. It's a threat to use nuclear weapons and to inflict all of the catastrophic harm that would result. So how can we change that? Australia can join this treaty and stay within the US alliance. Other countries have already done this. New Zealand, Thailand and the Philippines have all joined this treaty and they all maintain military alliances with the United States. And the US has had to accept that and respect that. So we feel that this is really inevitable and support is growing. We have hurdles to face, no doubt, but I think none of them are insurmountable. Currently, that's on the 20th of September last year, so the first day that the treaty opened for signature, we called on, this is on the roof of the Foreign Affairs Department in Canberra, and we took them a giant copy of the treaty to encourage them to sign and ratify. They didn't yet. So more than three quarters of all of the federal Labor parliamentarians have pledged to work for Australia to join the ban. So that's some of them. And that includes two-thirds of the shadow cabinet. So we need to turn this support into a clear commitment that a future Labor government would sign and ratify this treaty. And we have an opportunity to get that and to push for that at their December National Conference this year, when Labor will be deciding its policy on this treaty. South Australian Senator Penny Wong hasn't made up her mind yet on this treaty. She hasn't closed the door to signing it, but some recent things she's been saying and writing are pretty negative and quite misinformed as well. So please, what you can do as South Australians is to urge her to put Labor on the right side of history, to commit to put Australia on the right side of history on this, and to commit to join the treaty. So for this pledge, two government parliamentarians have signed. I think many more support this, but because the party's line is so clear and so public, they've said that they don't want to make a public declaration of support. All of the Greens have signed the pledge and several other crossbenchers. So the pledge is, I've got some copies here, it's basically a one-page document that any parliamentarian anywhere in the world can sign to say that they'll work for their country to join the treaty. And this is, we have a list that we keep up to date online, so as soon as any federal or state parliamentarian signs, then we update that list and we thank them on Twitter, and then everybody can stop sort of hassling them and encouraging them to sign. More than 20 unions and trades and labour councils around Australia have come out in support of the treaty, and many of those have become ICAN partner organisations. We currently have 77 partner organisations in Australia, and that's growing. On Tuesday this week, so 2 days ago, the Melbourne City Council unanimously passed a resolution endorsing a city's appeal, an ICAN city's appeal, saying that they support the treaty and that they clearly and firmly call on the federal government to sign and ratify the ban. So perhaps you could help us with the city of Adelaide and other cities and towns across Australia. So we have a very real opportunity to change Australia's perspective and position on this treaty, and it's up to us to make that happen. So my three-point call for help tonight is, one, check whether your state or federal MP or senator has pledged their support for the ban treaty with the pledge. And if they haven't, then please write to them, call them, visit the office, ask them to sign on to the pledge. Two, mobilise whatever union or Labor Party contacts you have. between now and December, because with their support, we could see a majority of delegates on the floor of that conference voting for a platform policy commitment that Labor will sign and ratify. Number three, donate to ICANN. We have a few monthly banner factors, and we run entirely on donations from our community. So with that, then we can plan ahead, and we've got a lot of sort of big ideas and not as much capacity as we would like, especially with the Labor conference and the federal election looming. So nuclear disarmament is unfinished business. This is us a couple of weeks ago in Canberra at the end of a 900-kilometre bike ride. Sorry that we didn't come via Adelaide, but it was a very long way between Melbourne, Adelaide to Canberra. That would have taken a long time, so we just went straight from Melbourne to Canberra. and it's unfinished business. It was the first resolution of the UN, and it's time that we finish it. I would like to quote Setsuko Thurlow, who you saw in one of the slides. This is something that she said on the day that she accepted the Nobel Prize. All responsible leaders will sign this treaty, and history will judge harshly those who reject it. No longer shall their abstract theories mask the genocidal reality of their practices. No longer shall deterrence be viewed as anything but a deterrent to disarmament. No longer shall we live under a mushroom cloud of fear.
We have on the IPAN South Australia Committee someone who I would call an iconoclast. He's sceptical of the treaty. And although I don't agree with him, I agree that I would ask his question. His concern is that the treaty could be used, given the power relationships in the world, the same way the NPT treaty is, to keep other states from developing nuclear weapons, but not do anything to effectively change the nuclear weapon states that now are, particularly the biggest ones. So how would you counter that how this committee is, this treaty is different from the NPT and will have much more effect?
So it's a different kind of treaty, but the main differences between the NPT and the Prohibition Treaty is the NPT doesn't outlaw nuclear weapons, and it doesn't actually compel the nuclear weapon states definitively to disarm. So it says in Article 6 that all states parties to this treaty must pursue effective measures related to nuclear disarmament and conclude negotiations in good faith. But there's no timeline, and the nuclear weapon states have been able to interpret that as being vague enough to not matter. So they have been able to go from 5 years to 5 years saying, look, the conditions are not right for us to disarm, so we want to look at the non-proliferation aspect a lot more and point our fingers at other countries and try to create this kind of tiered system where we're the good countries with nuclear weapons and other countries are the bad countries with nuclear weapons. Whereas the Ban Treaty makes the same standard for all countries. It says that nuclear weapons are illegal for everyone and all countries must disarm. Of course, it doesn't apply to countries that don't sign it. So nuclear weapon states, if they sign the treaty, they would have to undergo a negotiation process with the states' parties to work out a timeline to disarm. So they're resisting it, and they're saying we'll never sign this treaty. So there is a risk that it goes nowhere and that a few countries sign it and that's it. But it already looks like we've surpassed the point of that being a risk because so many countries have already signed and ratified it. And I think once some of the nuclear allied countries start signing, then that will really work to delegitimise the nuclear weapon states and to make them sort of have to look at it again. So the United States put out a memo to all of their NATO allies before the negotiations saying, don't support this because if this goes ahead, this will severely impact our ability to plan for nuclear war. So that was an indication to us that this treaty would be effective. There are five countries in Europe that host nuclear weapons, so if they sign the treaty, then they would have to remove those nuclear weapons from their territory. And that would impede on the US's ability to conduct exercises and to carry out their nuclear war plan. So there's all of that, and then there's the prohibitions in Article 1E around assisting, inducing, encouraging. That's really broad, so that includes financing. So one area that has already started to move is that financial institutions are divesting from nuclear weapons companies. The largest sovereign wealth fund in Norway has done this, and I think the largest pension fund in the Netherlands, and one bank in the US has divested from nuclear weapons, and all of them say it's because this treaty now exists. So for Australia, the Future Fund, which has, I think, around $250 million invested in nuclear weapons companies, we were doing some campaigning before the treaty existed, and we said, hey, you've divested from tobacco, landmines, cluster munitions, why do you still have money in nuclear weapons? And they said, because they're not prohibited by international law. Mm-hmm. So now that they are prohibited by international law, you know, even though the treaty hasn't entered into force yet, it's clearly going to, then that's something that we can use to go back and that will really have to.
Can I just ask a supplementary question, which is my own, not this other person's? Do you see that if Australia actually signed the treaty, that it would also mean that Pine Gap and Northwest Cape would have to close down, since they are direct communications links with nuclear weapons platforms? Effectively, the Pine Gap is one of the most important in the world, Northwest Cape with nuclear submarines. So would that be an interpretation that would be necessary under the treaty?
That's something that DFAT has said, but from our understanding, that's not necessarily the case at all, that they wouldn't have to close down.
Yes, Jim Rummelt, Executive Director of ICANN in Australia, talking about the nuclear ban treaty. I threw in those last two questions because it's important to realise that the treaty has limitations, and that's realistic. I mean, no treaty in itself is going to end the threat of nuclear war. But it can, as Jim Rummelt said, put extra pressure and significant pressure on the nuclear weapons states. And that's an important move forward to make, as it should be, the most powerful weapons in world history delegitimated by a lot of the bulk of the world saying no, they should be illegal. 122 states signed the treaty. Hopefully they will all eventually ratify it, or most of them, and that's a very powerful signal to send to the rest of the world. So we await with hope that. And Jim Rummelt said that the chances are good to ratify it, that is, reach 50 ratifications, which would bring the treaty into operation sometime in the next few months, or certainly within the next year, at the rate it's going now. So that would be great. So Jim Rummelt talking about the nuclear ban treaty.
So stay listening.
Stay listening, yes, yeah. And we'll certainly be reporting further on that. Now, our last section is something you want to talk about.
Well, it's council election times, local government council election times. So it's a really good opportunity to ask the people that are standing as for you to vote for about what they want to do about climate change, but also about divesting from fossil fuels. So do you know in your council area, Stephen, what people are saying?
I don't think that one has come up yet. I think that's a relatively new one. I mean, all the attention in my council has been on the APN and the support for a new start, which there is now in my council. But divestment so far is not a big issue. Possibly because poor La Linfield Council hasn't got very much money, but it's still important symbolically to talk about divestment from nuclear fuel and from banks that are investing in, not nuclear fuel, in fossil fuels.
Yeah. And certainly NAB made noises about not investing in anything that was to do with fossil fuel and mining of fossil fuel, but they were just noises. They didn't go anywhere, really. I think they've backed down from it now.
Thing is, though, the positive side of it is that it's actually not very profitable to invest in coal anyway.
Well, there must be.
Gas, there is, but yeah. Coal, no.
There must be profit in them because they're all doing it.
Well, yes, because the price of gas, because of the perverse policy of the federal government of selling a large amount of gas overseas, exporting it where the prices are higher, or allowing the companies to export it, means that the price of gas in Australia is artificially high, and so there's a lot of money can be made from it.
That's right.
We know about the fracking coming to Lee Creek, if they can get away with it. Fracking or at least gas mining, if you like, in the southeast in South Australia has been talked about. And there's an incredible number of wells in Queensland and New South Wales.
Absolutely.
And so that's where the profit's to be made, but not in coal, at least. But we shouldn't be making the distinction, because the latest information I have is that there's been a massive underestimation of how much fugitive emissions there are from gas, particularly methane. Now, as we all know, methane is the most potent greenhouse gas on the planet, 21 times more potent than carbon dioxide. But they have massively underestimated how much that gas is released from the pipes and the substations where they do the fracking, or even the conventional gas extraction like Moomba. And that means that the gas is a lot more dangerous even than we already know it now.
Yes, it's all difficult. But getting back to the banks, I live in the Adelaide City Council area. And Adelaide City Council has actually given a bit of a green light to moving away from preferencing banks that do not invest in fossil fuels. Mm. Sorry about that.
Yes, they have policies to that effect.
And quite a few of the councillors are for it, and certainly a couple of the mayoral candidates have stood up and said it very clearly, and I think that's a really positive move. And one of the councillors raised that there's the Bendigo Bank that doesn't, and Bendigo Bank has merged now and has become the Adelaide Bendigo Bank, and that is one bank that does not invest in anything to do with fossil fuel. But a fellow who lives in where I live at, did live at Christie Walk, has written this letter, and I'd love to read it for people because I think it's really good. It's directed to our councillors. You'll be aware that the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change recently reported that rapid and far-reaching transitions, including to quickly reduce fossil fuel use, are required in order to stave off dangerous climate change likely to occur if we overshoot a 1.5 degree Celsius rise from the pre-industrial global temperature. And that is in itself a really strong statement to get people to come out and actually question where we're going, because there was an audit report also done by the Adelaide Council that it's not going to cost people too much money. It's not going to make much difference to the bottom line for councils to do this, because, and that's the argument. Everyone says that it'll cost too much money.
Hmm.
But they're actually saying that it's not. The audit showed that it actually isn't. And the several councils city councils have already said that they're only going to preference banks that do not invest. So you can sense that there's a bit of a move, that a positive move.
Yeah, well, I mean, it has both direct tangible effects on the fossil fuel industry, in that it reduces their access to funds, And it has important, it's a bit like the nuclear disarm or the nuclear ban treaty. It delegitimizes fossil fuels, which certainly should be done. It's been an important part of the Adani campaign that, in fact, Adani is finding it incredibly difficult to get any funding for its mine in the Galilee Basin. And because their funding has been reduced, they have resorted to, now they've abandoned the idea of having a double track full railway from the Galilee Basin to the Abbots Point terminal, which is quite a long way. And they're now talking about a I think it's a single track, but anyway, it's a narrow gauge track into the current network, which is significantly shorter because they haven't got the money.
Yes.
And they can't access the money. They haven't been allowed to access the Northern Infrastructure Funds because, although the federal government is in favour of it, the states have to agree to it as well. And two or three of the states have said, no, we won't agree to that sort of funding of Adani. So that's an indication of where the pressures are coming. Now, of course, that is about coal, and gas is different. Gas is very profitable in Australia at present. But still, we go further down the track. And especially after that latest IPCC announcement.
Well, exactly, from Korea.
Yeah, well, the announcement.
From the October 8th meeting of the report on global warming.
The report that said that we're, in fact, in a lot worse state than we are now. I think basically what happened was that they, for the first time, they took into account all those things, the feedback mechanisms, the multiplier effects that they hadn't done before because they were trying to be conservative in order to, you know, stave off the deniers. But I think they've dropped that now, the scientists, and they said, well, this is what's actually going to happen.
Yeah.
By 2030, we're completely stuffed unless we have made substantial progress.
And that was seen once as a bit conservative, that body. But what they're actually coming out and saying now, it's actually worth a read, that report from...
Well, so many other multiplier effects are in place, particularly the methane from the permafrost melting in Canada and Siberia and, well, northern Russia. That makes a whole new game, if you like, in terms of the impact on greenhouse gases. And the Australian government's stance on that was well, both disgusting and ludicrous.
Absolutely woeful.
You know, saying that we will still meet our targets, our woefully inadequate targets, but according to the bodies that actually count it within the Australian government, there's no chance of meeting the Paris targets under present trajectory.
Well, that's right.
You know?
I've got a list here in front of me of the scientists and authors of the report, and it's huge. It's absolutely huge, the list, from 44 different countries, and that's just the authors of the report. There's other countries that are signing on to it. But when people say, well, we haven't seen the proof, well, they haven't looked at this report.
Oh, well, don't you worry. Several Australian cabinet ministers have still said, oh, we don't believe these scientists, because they have such scientific credentials themselves, obviously, that they know. I mean, Melissa Price, the environment minister, at least the environment ministers in the past in Australia, in the federal Liberal coalition, have tried to at least present a front as if they gave some acknowledgement of these issues. But she didn't. She's just talking, you know, oh, we don't believe this. We don't accept this, you know.
So we urge all councillors, all people standing for council, to read this report and to make as part of their platform divestment from fossil fuel.
Well, as in the US, in Australia, it's other governments that are both the state government level and hopefully at local government level that are bypassing federal government positions
exactly
on this. I mean, you know.
But I think you start with I do actually believe that that's local council is true democracy.
Yeah.
We do have a choice. We do have choices of who we can vote for, and we can actually influence them in what we want.
Good. Well, there you go. We are coming to an end now for a piece of the action for this day. And we gave you a diverse coverage of what I'm calling the three horsemen of the apocalypse. I won't add a fourth. We've got three. It's enough, I think.